The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test. Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. Don't wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
It's gonna have to be a different man. Sides, but never leave the stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. Don't tell them to blow up out of it.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Where's your shame? You've left us up to her next to me.
Time may change me, but you can't twist time.
Welcome, everybody, to Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks, live and for your enjoyment here on the Para-X Radio Network. We're glad that you joined us tonight, and your wonderful host, Marla Brooks, is waiting in the wings, ready to entertain you, enlighten you, educate you, and I know that you're going to have a lot of fun tonight. So, Marla, take it away.
Thanks, Dave, and I'm waiting in the bat wings. Let's make that, you know, a little bit more clear, because that would just be more apropos. Anyway, everybody, merry meet. Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on Para-X. And tonight we're going to be talking about magical identity with my guest, author Taylor Elwood. He's the managing nonfiction editor for Emanian Press and is also the author of 7 other books on occultism. He started practicing an eclectic mix of neo-shamanism and elemental hermeticism and gradually found his way to Golden Dawn ceremonial magic. He practiced that for a while before moving on to ceremonial magical practices that fell kind of outside the usual practices that most magicians know about. He focused on the ceremonial work of William Gray and Franz Bardon, as well as other writers not as well known as perhaps Aleister Crowley, but definitely more interesting. He eventually graduated to chaos magic and from there started developing his own systems of magic, which he continues to do to this day. Taylor has also studied and practiced Taoist, Tibetan, and Buddhist meditation and internal alchemy techniques, and these inform a lot of his practices today. His focus as a magician is to innovate and experiment with what can be done magically, which I think is very, very cool. And instead of settling for what others have done, he prefers to walk his own path. And at this point, he feels that internal work is an absolute must for any magician to fully realize his or her potential. So, Taylor, hi, welcome to the show.
Ah, thank you very much. That's quite an introduction of me. I'm flattered.
I dug deep. That worked well.
Yeah. Now, wow, that's cool. So thank you for having me on here.
I'm really kind of excited about this because this is something that I never really thought about for some reason. And, you know, when reading your book and listening to a couple of shows that you've done, kind of opened my eyes about things. And Magical Identity explores magic from an ontological perspective to show why identity is an essential part of magical practice. And so this might be a good time to define the term ontological.
Well, when we're talking about the term ontological or really ontology, we're talking about state of being or the essence of something as opposed to, you know, doing something. We're really talking about embodiment. That's what I tend to think of when I think of ontology or the ontological exploration of identity is really the embodiment of identity. What does it mean to be you? What does it mean when you relate that to different aspects of yourself, such as your body or your culture or your familial heritage or a variety of other things, all of which have some form of influence upon the identity that you embody in your everyday life.
Mm-hmm. All right, so how does identity apply to magic?
Well, you know, when we think about magical work, the typical approach is, I need to get something out there, some kind of result, and bring it into my life to fix a problem or make my life a bit easier or something else along those lines. That's what you see in some approaches to magic. Or it's to make a spiritual connection with a deity or some other form of entity. But when I look at magic, I think of it as it's really a methodology and force that a person uses to change their place in the universe, their identity. And so the reason I think it's so important to examine identity is because an effective magician understands that to make those kinds of changes, you need to first change what's going on internally and then match it up with what you want to change externally around you. And within Western magic, what I've tended to see is more of a focus on the environment around you. Well, we're going to change this environment around us. And, you know, great, but if that result that you've tried to get doesn't stay with you, if it's not there in the long term, there's probably something going on internally within you that's not allowing it to stay there. And that's why I think an exploration of identity is so important, because by getting in there and really exploring your identity, then you can say, does this really align with the result that I want to achieve? And if it doesn't, what is it that I need to change about myself to make that align?
Right.
And do I even want to make that change?
Yeah. And some people will say, can I make that change? And I think we know that, yes, we can. Anything we put our mind to, we can do. But sometimes it's a hindrance to the others, you know, it's because people always fall back on, well, that's who I am, you know, like it or hate it, but that's who I am. I can't change. Can't being the operative word a lot. And that kind of gets frustrating after a while, because we all can. It's just a matter of will and wanting to, right?
Very much so. That's part of it. But also part of it is really understanding what that change entails. What are the values and beliefs that create that change? And again, this is where, you know, the concept of will can be useful, but it's also a recognition that change goes beyond even the will, because the will is a conscious application of a person's consciousness toward making change. But sometimes what we're working on changing is something that goes much, much deeper than that, and that's where that ontological aspect of identity comes into play, because what we're really trying to change is that deeper identity. And that conscious application of will can help with that, but we've also got to respect that what we're really digging into is something much, much deeper, that part of ourselves that is defined by culture, physiology, family, other spirituality, a variety of other things, all of which constitutes to some one degree or another the identity that we embody in our lives.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I asked you how identity applies to magic. Let's switch it around. Conversely, how can magic apply to identity?
Well, that's a really good question. And what I would say is that magic applies to identity in the sense that it is something we can use to bring changes to identity. So, for example, if we're going to work with our familial heritage and how that has an impact on our identity, and we want to change that, one of the things that we can actually do is go and work with our ancestors, our spiritual ancestors, as well as our genetic ancestors. And we can use magic as a way to do that kind of work. And so by going in and being able to enter into a dialogue with our ancestors toward that purpose of perhaps changing a familial pattern of behavior, then we, and specifically being able to change it within ourselves, not so much that we can change it in our family, but that we change it within ourselves so that we're no longer embodying it, that at the same time we can bring a level of conclusion to that particular pattern within the family, as at least as how it is expressed through our own identity. And magic would play a role in that through allowing us to work with our ancestors in that particular way.
Mm-hmm. Now, why has the topic or the subject of identity basically been ignored in occultism?
Well, I think what it really comes right down to is that there is more of a focus on willing something to be. We have a lot of focus on will and on consciousness, and we also have a lot of focus on the psychology of magic these days. You know, there's magicians who argue that it's all in your head, and it's kind of one of those cases where it's consequently we ignore that. We also have within some of the Western culture a tendency to take practices such as Buddhism, what have you, and then modify them in such a way so that we say, well, we're going to apply them to a Western approach to it, and so we're going to kill the ego. We're going to kill that part of ourselves that constitutes the ego. And so you see this to some degree in some of the writings by Robert Anton Wilson and Timothy Leary, but you also see it played out in some of the interpretations of Buddhism that occurs over here in the U.S. And so it's a case where I think that we've kind of been taught to avoid that question of identity and the exploration of it, because there's this idea that if we try to explore it, we'll become too attached to it, and we won't be able to transcend this particular realm. And it's interesting, because when we look at Western culture, there is a particular focus on transcending, you know, the physical. You see it within Christianity, you see it within Islam as well, where there's that focus on reaching heaven or reaching, you know, some higher plane of existence. And I think it's fair to say that some of that translates over into paganism and into some of the occult practices as well, because it's a cultural aspect to our identity. It's 2,000 years of cultural identity that has shaped the way that we approach spirituality. And so it's not surprising then that we might take a practice, say, from the Far East and apply that cultural perspective, that cultural identity to that practice in order to then consequently take it and say, well, we're going to use this to get away from identity because identity represents this thing that we're not supposed to want.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Now, I mean, your approach is really different and really neat in a lot of things. And in talking about the seven phases of alchemy working, mm-hmm. We know it's commonly suggested that visualization is the key, and we hear the term always about visualization applied to almost everything we do in the magical realm. But you say you don't have much use for visualization and that it's kind of a poor substitute for actual experience. So can we delve a little bit deeper into that?
There is a tendency to use visualization to describe how you can approach a magical work. And one thing I want to note, first of all, is that visualization operates along the lines of the privilege of being able to see.
Mm-hmm.
Most people can see, but what do you do for somebody who's blind and can't see? Oh, visualize this. What does that mean for that person?
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but even though many people can see, that doesn't necessarily mean that sight is the most beneficial sense to draw upon when we're talking about magical work. For example, I tend to be a very tactile person, and so I find touch to be an essential part of how I work with magic.
Mm-hmm.
But even putting that aspect aside, when it comes down to it, ideally with magical work, what we are doing is we are embodying the changes that we want to manifest within our lives. And so visualization is kind of up there in the ether. It's kind of visiting the astral plane, and you know, there's values. There's some value to all of that, but there's also something to be said for being able to bring that change into our lives by actually embodying it and making it into a principle that we actually fully act out within the environment around us. A lot of how I like to approach magic now is I actually like to, you know, invoke the particular change that I want to bring into a space, and then allow myself to move and present that change to the space that I'm within, that kind of creating a sacred space where there's movement that we actually do to embody and represent that change. And the reason for that is because instead of just kind of keeping it in our head, we're actually making it into something that is in the environment around us. We're saying, I am actually ready to handle this and make it part of my life.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Now, your book explains how we can change identity and why making those changes are the most effective magical practice we'll ever learn. And the first quote that caught my eye was, identity is central to the practice of magic. So how does one go about finding and then choosing our magical identities?
Well, this is where internal work definitely plays a role. I think that although you can certainly do a lot of magic without internal work, I think it tends to be reactive magic. In other words, it's done as a reaction to something that occurs in your life. You know, a problem comes up or something else occurs, and so you do magic as a way to fix the issue. But when we're doing internal work, we're actually taking a proactive approach to magic. And so what we're doing is we're going in and we're working with those the beliefs and values that we have. We're going in and we're shaping our identity. And I'll use a personal example.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I was doing a year-long ritual where I was working with the element of earth. And not surprisingly, one of the themes that came up at that time was working with financial issues and money and wealth. And I ended up having to really do a lot of internal work with that, because even though I was good at managing money, the money that I had, I didn't really have a clear idea of what I wanted to actually do with that money. So I'd go in and I would work and get that job, and or go and work at the job that I was working at, and you know, make however much an hour I made, and there I had it, and you know, it was good for paying off some debts, etc. But I had no real sense of what it meant, what I was going to do with it beyond that. And for that matter, I really just didn't even have a sense of what it meant to embody wealth within my life. And at the time, I was living in Seattle. Didn't like living there at all. Absolutely hated it. And it was about probably in May of 2007 that my ex-wife and I had decided we were going to move down to Portland. I loved it there. It was kind of interesting. My friends said at the time, they said, when you're up in Seattle, you're really depressed, but when you come down here, you get very animated and excited. And so that was kind of a good sign. But I had this very curious reaction when we were getting ready to move. It was like a couple months beforehand, and all of a sudden I started saying, well, maybe we should stay in Seattle. And my ex-wife kind of looked at me and was like, what? What kind of head trip are you pulling on me? Understandably so. And what I ended up realizing was that I was reading a book at the time called Secrets of the Millionaire Mind by T. Harv Eker. And one of the things that he pointed out is that, you know, we have our limiting beliefs, and that until we look at those limiting beliefs about money and about wealth, we can't really make changes to how we manage our money. And he was right, but I looked at it as even in regards to my life. And so suddenly I applied that idea to the circumstances, and I came up with this realization that something I'd learned from my mom and something that she had learned from her family, which was that you have to struggle in order to be happy. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about it, that's not the kind of belief you really want to embody in your life. I don't think anybody really wants to embody it. But if it's something that you've learned and it makes a sort of kind of sense, even if it goes unexamined, then that's what you're going to embody in your life. And that's exactly what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So when I ended up going in and looking at this belief and then started to trace it back to its origins, traced it back to the fact that I learned it from my mom, and then traced it even further, you know, thinking about some of her stories and tracing that back to what she had said about her family, I realized that really what I was doing is I was choosing to embody this belief in my life, and it was part of my identity, and I decided to change that. And once I changed that belief, what ended up happening is that I no longer felt this conflict about moving to Portland. And what was really interesting after that was that shortly after that, I landed a job out down there. And, you know, everything just kind of seemed to flow a lot more easily than it had before, because I was no longer putting up a fight against getting what I really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I use as an example of why internal work is so important, because sometimes your greatest obstacle is yourself, and you can be better at blocking yourself than anything else around you from getting what you really want.
Mm-hmm. Well, just sitting there and trying to figure out some of the changes that need to be made and stuff, do we have to have kind of like a V8 moment where something pops into our head and says, wait a minute, that needs to be changed? Or is it something that we can do through meditation? Or, you know, how do we get to that point where finding out who we are, with, you know, our identity, and then understanding what needs to be changed happens?
Meditation is definitely useful for that purpose. I think that many people have V8 moments in their lives, and I think that it's, and that's one approach. It's a kind of a haphazard one, because it's sort of waiting until you've gotten the lesson enough times before you finally realize, oh, wait a minute. But meditation is very useful for that kind of practice, especially if we go into meditation with the idea of, I'm going to go in and actually use it as a way to examine certain behavior patterns I'm observing within myself, or certain situations that are coming up in my life that seem to repeatedly occur. I'm going to go in there and actually work with those particular I'm going to kind of look at what my role is within those particular situations and see what it is that I can discover about what it is that I seem to be attracting. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it within me that is calling for those particular things? And it's interesting, because when you start to apply this internal work to your life, what ends up happening is that you find that the need to do more overt acts of magic actually decreases. It's not to say that it goes away altogether. There are times and places when you may need to do some magical work, you know, for something that comes up. Mm-hmm. But precisely because you're going in and using meditation to kind of work through things, it actually ends up making it much easier for you to align yourself to the right kinds of circumstances that you want to bring into your life. And when you do need to do magic, it makes it a lot easier for the magic to work for you, because you're no longer blocking yourself on a subconscious level from actually achieving the result you want to manifest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a question from chat along those lines from Cece in the chat room. And she's asking, she said, those magicians who are here for the sole purpose of a magical life and know it. Wait, something is missing here. Wait a minute. I only got half this message. 1 second. Okay. Are there those magicians who are here for the sole purpose of a magical life and know it, as opposed to having an aha moment?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I would have to ask back, define what a magical life is. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Because, okay, you know, your definition of what a magical life is going to be something that I think will really influence that. And so it's kind of one of those cases where I'd look at that and I'd say, what does that mean to you?
Mm-hmm. And I would kind of say that each one of us, our magical lives are probably independent of anybody else's.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think I'm living a magical life right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the various circumstances that I've encountered and the obstacles and things like that have been just as instructive for that, in terms of really allowing me to see what it is that I can learn from various experiences. You know, we have setbacks in our lives, and that it's actually a good thing to have some setbacks, because it teaches us to become resilient and to change and adapt. And I think that's very much a part of a magical life as well. Now, other people might disagree, but, you know, whatever works for you. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and you know, we were talking about changing identity being the central practice of magic, but I also think that knowing who we are, magicians or not, you know, it's important for everybody, vitally important to know who we are, not just in magical works, but as human beings. There's always those changes that need to be made. If you dig a little bit deeper, things can work out. You don't have to... you don't have to do a spell to figure that out, you know?
Exactly.
Well, Cece just wrote back. She goes, yeah, I kind of followed the Dion Fortune idea of reincarnated ceremonial magicians who are back for a purpose.
Okay. Well, it's kind of interesting, because my wife actually works with... R.J. Stewart sometimes, who's another author, and he actually studied with William Gray, who studied with Dion Fortune. So there's kind of a little bit of a lineage there. And so, you know, we've actually talked about that particular idea. And I think that, you know, that can certainly be the case. But I would look even at them being reincarnated and kind of looking at that concept and say, all right, what is it that they're here to learn? Not just in turn, and also what is it that they're here to do? And how does their identity embody that and allow them to accomplish that particular purpose? And how does them being able to draw on the fact that they were a ceremonial magician or whatever else in another life, how does that in turn allow them to fulfill that particular calling? Because I think that if we look at the concept of a magical life from that sense, they still ultimately have to deal with the realities of everyday life. You know, they've still got to be able to pay the bills and do whatever else. And in fact, I would argue that's not necessarily a bad thing altogether, because that in and of itself grounds them and grounds what they're doing into the recognition that they are dealing with the everyday facets of life, and that being able to apply that magic to their lives is still nonetheless going to have to accept that. And it can actually enhance their working, because then they have an understanding of how what they're doing relates to the everyday person and the kinds of situations and struggles that an everyday person goes through. Somebody who doesn't practice magic, for instance, but maybe needs to encounter that reincarnated person who can help them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. Now, the concept of identity is not adequately understood or utilized in magical practice as much as it should be. For example, and you mentioned this earlier, what does this have to do with ego? Let's go into that again.
Well, one thing we need to bear in mind is that when we use the word ego and consciousness and unconscious and all that, we're really relying upon outdated terms for psychology. We're relying on terms that were developed by Freud a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising. It's not surprising that we see these terms used to an extent even now. By various people when they're talking about magic. And I even used it in magical identity. I talked about ego. I defined it as a set of filters that kind of filters the experience a person has and kind of provides a use, and that those filters serve as a way to kind of serve as gatekeepers for the access to a person's identity. So when I look at terms like that and I think what I see is a reliance on psychology and maybe too much of a reliance on psychology, because psychology is ultimately it ultimately is dealing with the mental aspects of a person's life. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't explore that, but we also need to recognize that with magic, and really with identity as well, that we're dealing with a multi-tiered experience. You know, we're dealing with a spiritual aspect, we're dealing with a mental aspect, we're dealing with a physiological aspect, and I'm going to count emotions as part of a physiological experience of magic. Some people might not, but that's kind of how I look at them based off of my study of neuroscience and such. But we really need to explore magic and identity from those levels, as well as from a social level, not just a psychological level, but a social level, which is where that focus on culture and familial/ancestral heritage comes into play, because all of those things influence identity. Identity is not something that we can just kind of separate. It is an experience that is comprised of all those influences that shape our lives on a regular basis, even when we don't consciously recognize them.
Right. Now, let's talk about ontology versus psychology, since you kind of touched on that for a second.
Okay.
Because they're both like not tangible things, you know.
Well, with psychology, we're really exploring. We tend to think of psychology. A lot of people tend to think of going in to see your therapist and talking about your issues, whatever those the dysfunctions that show up within your life. And I think that's certainly one layer of psychology. But another layer of psychology is how we think and how we learn. Identity, on the other hand, when we're exploring it as an ontological thing, we're really looking at it in terms of what is it that makes a person a person. And there is some crossover, because, for example, if we look at family identity, we can also apply that to psychology. Psychology can also be applied to that, and we can say, how are the family issues passed on to the next, you know, to the son or daughter, and how are those issues played out in that person's life? Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be some crossover, but I think the main difference is that the ontological exploration of magic really is more about a beingness as opposed to focus on an issue or on a term such as, you know, what is the consciousness as opposed to what is the ego and the unconsciousness. We're really exploring the totality of the person, and that includes things that may not be accessible via consciousness, but nonetheless are still there and comprise that person's life.
Okay. So basically, internal work is the center of all this, isn't it?
You know, I would say that internal work is the means to access identity, and so it's the exploration of identity via meditation. Some of it may be via some psychological techniques or other things that are out there, but it goes beyond that, because what it's also dealing with is a spiritual exploration of identity as well.
All right, this may be sounding like a really dumb question, but...
Ask away.
Does everybody need to do this internal work? Does everybody need to go deep and look hard? Or are some people just okay as they are and it works for them? Or does everybody need to jump in and just dig a little deeper?
I think everyone needs to. When you look at the various problems that are within our society and everything else, I think that what it really comes down to is everyone needs to be doing this kind of work.
Right.
You know, it's something where when we don't do that work, when we live an unexamined life, what we're really opening ourselves to is ignorance of ourselves and of what we could be. And really, you know, I see this kind of work as fully exploring the potential, but also being able to make changes for the betterment of our lives. Living a less complicated life is always preferable to complicating it even more. And we all know people who bring lots of drama around them. You know, they're always complaining about someone or something, or they're always, you know, there's always something going on with them, and those people especially need to be doing eternal work, because if they did, they would find that the level of drama would significantly decrease, because they would finally be doing something that we all need to do, which is take responsibility for ourselves and for what we choose to embody within our lives. And not surprisingly, when people have a lot of drama, they themselves cause a lot of it because of what they're choosing to embody. They may not take responsibility for it, but nonetheless, it's still very much present in there.
Right. A little bit earlier, you were talking about Western magical approaches or Western magic. How does Western magic differ from others?
Well, what I see is that Eastern forms of magic or mystical practices like Taoism and Buddhism, and also the Tibetan Bon practices, that there's some elements that would be similar to Western magic, particularly within the Tibetan Bon practices, you know, of working with spirits and things along those lines. But there's also a balanced approach. There is a recognition of the need to do internal work. Within Taoism, you have, you know, the circulating of the qi and the creation of the golden embryo and the idea really of being able to, again, do this internal work as part of your daily life. And within Western magic, you might see it to some degree, but it's not as developed, and it's much more. It's in some ways it's much more elaborate in terms of the ceremonial aspects, and you know, kind of like it kind of takes me back to the days when I was learning about Kabbalah and you know, learning about the Sephiroth and everything. There's definitely a way to take that and apply it internally and to work with it. But I think that what I saw in it was a lot more complication than there needed to be. And the majority of books on Western magic tend to focus more on changing the environment around you. You know, we've got tons of spell books, tons of 101 books, a lot of an approach that really just says, let's, you know, if there's a problem in your life, go and use magic to solve it. Mm-hmm. But there's not really an emphasis on going in and doing internal work. And you know, we all have problems in our lives, and sometimes magic is the appropriate way to handle it. Mm-hmm. But even when magic is the appropriate way to handle those problems, until we examine what it is that we are choosing to embody within our lives, we really can't make effective change. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I didn't find in Western magic. I found it by going to the East, so to speak, and learning Taoism and Buddhist meditation and the Tibetan Bon approaches, and then taking that and bringing it back and kind of applying it to the Western magical work that I was doing. And as I said, I found that the need to do more overt displays of magic consequently diminished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you defined magic as an agreement with the universe, and I really like that. But for those who may not understand that, can you explain what you meant?
Well, the typical definition of magic, the one that's quoted the most often, is Crowley's thing, which is magic is the art and science of causing change to occur occur in conformity with the will. And we'll even throw in a love is the law, love under, you know, all that. But when I look at it, I think that when I think about magic causing, you know, and changing the agreement with the universe, what I look at is I think of identity as really as the agreement that we have with the universe. We embody this particular agreement within our lives. So the circumstances that we're in, the various situations that we encounter, all of those are, you know, constitute this identity. And when we want to make changes, what we're really doing is we're saying to the universe as well as to ourselves, we're saying, I'm ready to make this change within my life. And so what we're doing is we're changing that agreement. And if we do it right, we're changing it in such a way that it's a permanent change that's for the betterment of ourselves and ideally for the universe as well. I think that you know, ideally magic is something that we use to improve not merely ourselves, but also the environment around us. That really we apply it with the understanding that we're trying to do a transformative action that allows us to change our place within the universe, but also change the universe for the better because we're doing that. Mm-hmm.
Now, in your book, you talk about the late Isaac Bonowitz and his laws of magic, and I had the pleasure of having him on my show a few years ago, and he was brilliant.
Yes, he was.
His law of association deals with identity in what way?
It's the idea of you create an association of like is, you know, something that's similar to each other, and you associate it. So there's some kind of correspondence there that allows you to create an association and turn one thing into the other thing. It's kind of interesting you mention him, because I actually met him. I met him a few times in my life, not very often, but I actually had the rare pleasure of getting a few hours of his time one evening, and he and I sat down and talked at length about magic and some of the things that he was working on at the time, and we talked a bit about some of his laws. And what stood out to me about it about that is that Isaac had a very strategic way of looking at magic. And so when we look at this, the law of association, it was really based on the idea that you can create an association with just about anything as long as you understand what it is that that thing has in common with something else. And you use that association to basically create the circumstances that allows you to manifest the change using that association as the linkage for that magical act. So you're right. He was very brilliant. Very, very interesting fellow. He left us far too soon.
Yes, he did. He did. Now, one of the really nice things about the book, in addition to all the information in it, is that you provide exercises in each chapter and also invocations. And but you have some really interesting approaches, because while there may be guidelines set and suggestions offered, your main message here is that people should take the ideas that they read about in the book and the suggestions and make them their own, which is completely different than many other books in general, because authors always believe that their way is the only way. So, I mean, kudos to you for that. It's giving everybody a chance to have their free will and think and put it all together. And I really like that.
Thank you. I tend to take a descriptive approach to magic as opposed to a prescriptive approach. A prescriptive approach is basically, like you said, it's my way or the highway. This is the way to do it, and this is the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. A descriptive approach breaks down how you're doing what you're doing, and it says, here's one way to do it, but you can also take it and work with it in other ways. And I tend to think of magic as a very personalized experience, in part because it is so experiential.
Right.
You know, it's not a science. It's not meant to be a science. When we try to make it into a science, we're really trying to rigidly define it as in a very set way. But that very set way may not work for everyone. It goes back to my example of when I talked about visualization. Not everybody is visually focused. Mm-hmm. So if we're not all visually focused, visualization isn't going to work that well for everybody who doesn't tend to approach life in that way. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing here. By learning to take a descriptive approach to magic, we understand the value of defining it and defining the various processes that we can do, but we also understand the value of giving people enough room to make it their own. Mm-hmm. And that's the key.
Yeah, I agree 1,000%. Now, another interesting thing that I found in the book is you talk about using sigils to manifest results. But you take it one step further. You incorporate vibration into that work, which I find a rather fascinating approach. How is that accomplished?
Well, first of all, we need to recognize that sound is one of the essential elements of the universe. It may not be in the classic 4 or 5 element model, but nonetheless, it's something that's always present. I mean, right now you and I are talking and we're sending vibrations to each other. Of course, technology and all that's helping. It's translating it into vibrations, but nonetheless, it's still plenty. It's something that's there, and it's interesting because William G. Gray actually talked about the power of vocalization or vibrating an invocation that you do. The idea being that really what you're doing is you're attuning yourself through that invocation to the spiritual force that you want to invoke. And you're using that vibration to basically provide it a path so that it can reach you and align itself with you and fully come into its own. And so that's kind of one of the things that I do with sigils is I do that vibration. And the idea of using that kind of vibration is that it really helps us to take the sigil and uses it to fully reach out to that possibility that the sigil is representing and invoke that possibility into our reality using the vibrations as part of the the process, because sound is a physical force. And in a lot of ways, the way that I approach magic is really that that it's something that we're bringing into physical manifestation. So sound is a physical manifestation of what it is that we're trying to bring into reality. And it actually creates a path of least resistance by vibrating, by basically taking this sound and using it to the vibrations to really align the possibility that we're trying to achieve into the reality that we happen to embody.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a fascinating, you know, it never occurred to me, but it's really, really, really interesting to think about. One of the other things that you mentioned earlier was Aleister Crowley, and I was listening to another interview that you did recently where you spoke about him, and you're not a major fan of his, but your reasoning isn't personal. Can you explain that?
I'm not a major fan of his because I see far too many magicians quote him, talk about him, and show no interest in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Crowley was certainly an influential person within Western magic. Some of that came down to the fact that he was really good at marketing himself in a notorious way. You know, he was at one time billed the wickedest man on Earth or whatever, and he certainly hammed it up. Whether I don't think he was the wickedest man on Earth. I think that would have been reserved for Hitler, who lived in that time. But you know, Crowley certainly liked to ham it up. And the problem is that, you know, Crowley's been dead since 1949, I think, maybe 1948. And it's 2012. And here's the reality. 2012 is a much different time, much culture's different, everything else. Why are we still using this one person's words to define our approach to magic? Why aren't we defining it? Why aren't we exploring magic for ourselves? And that's kind of the challenge I throw out there to anybody who's just so focused on Crowley is put the books down by him, start reading some other stuff, start trying some other things, and see what happens. And hey, go back to him as needed, you know, apply his stuff. He has things of value to say, but don't rely just on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of other information out there. Got a question in chat going back to the sigils for a minute. Cece's wondering, are you saying to chant to the sigil or invoke a wish to it?
I'm saying to chant to the sigil, to basically take the sigil and take whatever sound you came up with that represents that sigil and chant it, you know, vocalize it, really vibrate it. And when I talk about vibrate, It's like saying, let me put it this way. It's like saying, hum. You hear that vibration? That's what I'm talking about. It's not just saying the word. It's feeling the word through sound.
Okay, good. Now, in addition to writing books and offering spiritual coaching, you also teach classes. So what do you teach, and how can our listeners find out more about that?
Well, I occasionally teach classes at conventions such as PantheaCon, which occurs up in every February. But I'm also in the process of developing some correspondence courses, and I'm actually about to go live with my first one called The Process of Magic. And if you go to my website, magicalexperiments.com, you can actually find information about it. And it's a course where basically people will get lessons each week from me about, you know, the process of magic, basically how to create their own process of magic. That's what the focus of the course is on. Mm-hmm. And the idea is really to develop your own personalized system of magic in order to increase its efficacy. We talk a fair amount about internal work. We talk about how you can take the concept of process and apply it to magic. And when I talk about the concept of process, what I'm really talking about, comes from my days of technical writing and where you can document anything. You can document any set of practices or activities or anything, and you can create a process around it. And the same applies to magic, but it's learning how to develop an awareness of that so that you can go in and modify and improve your magical work, because you can actually approach it from the perspective of process and see what's working and what isn't. Find the weak link in your magical work, and then make the appropriate changes.
I really love this non-dogmatic approach. You know, again, it's just because we're all so different in the way we think, the way we act, the way we react, that you're not excluding anybody in this. You know, because some people say, well, I don't want to do it that way because it doesn't mesh with my way of thinking or my belief system. And you're just throwing stuff out there as bait, and then everybody else can swim up to it and do with it what they want. And I find that just absolutely fascinating and wonderful.
Well, that's how we can approach magic. It doesn't have to be dogmatic. And in fact, when we learn that it doesn't have to be dogmatic, we then start to really discover how we can utilize it as a transformative principle for our lives, because we're no longer relying upon what one person has to say about it. Instead, we're becoming our own authorities.
Mm-hmm. And does that have to do with it? I know we're running out of time, so we don't have a lot to delve into this, but you talk about conducting magical experiments. And that's, I'm guessing that's what we all should kind of do in a sense, right?
Well, I think that, yeah, we all could do that. That's definitely my approach to magic. I like to experiment with things, try new things out. I'm very creative, and that kind of informs my approach to magic. So I think, you know, if everyone wants to do that, they certainly can. I say that only because I know that there will be some people who will be appalled at that idea. You know, again, that it's got to be one true way. But you know what? It doesn't. It's yours to make, not someone else's.
Right, which is the same as life. You know, the life that we lead is ours to make, our choice, what directions to take. I mean, you know, when I do tarot readings for people, I tell them, you know, this isn't gospel. Look at it as a roadmap. And, you know, if you don't like what you see, change it. You know, you're totally entitled to do that. And
definitely.
This is how, I mean, this is the great approach, because there's no binders there. There's nothing that says you're right, you're wrong, blah, blah, blah. You know, make your own decision. But the important thing, I think, is to get the basics. And as you said, more importantly, internal workings and trying to figure out where the course needs correcting and how to go about doing that. And your book is just absolutely full of that, in a good way. I mean, you know, it's a very helpful guide for anybody that just kind of wants to make things better. And we can. And that's the other thing it explains. We can. We are in charge. So, I mean, it's a great concept and a great book, and I learned a lot. I did, and I haven't even, like, sat down word by word by word yet, you know, because it isn't like, you know, a Dr. Seuss thing where you pick it up and you can finish it in one day. No, you need to really read and think, but it gives your mind a good workout, too, and that's fantastic. And speaking of the book, where can people find it?
They can find it on my website, magicalexperiments.com. They can find it at Emanian Press's website, emanian-press.com. You can find it at your local occult bookstore, and if they don't have it, you can request that they have them request it through New Leaf Distribution, and you can also find it on Amazon. And I also have it available as an ebook. So if that's your fancy, you can get it as an ebook as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we, as usual, are out of time because it just flies by too much. But I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight. Again, it's a fascinating subject, and I know we all really appreciate the appreciate the insight that you've brought. And as usual, guys, I want to thank you all for listening in tonight, because if it weren't for you, I'd be sitting here talking to myself. And while that might happen on occasion, it's way more fun to share. So until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Good night, and thank you very much.
We tried.